You ever been in that situation where you show up to like a party or a reception, some sort of large social gathering, and you're early? You're like the only one there, or maybe one of two or three people who are there in this big empty room. Feels kind of awkward. But then slowly but surely, eventually people start to trickle in, and before you know it, it's a packed house. That's kind of how I feel tonight in regards to being somebody who's been highly critical of Donald Trump, being somebody who has been highly critical of the Republican Party and who's been wondering what it is that we are doing right now as a party, what being a Republican even means. As of today, as of the signing of this budget bill, it suddenly seems as though the room has been packed. And I've been sitting here with a few scattered others wondering when the party was going to start, and all of a sudden it's wall to wall. Something has shifted. The winds have changed. This is a significant moment. And granted, my basis for judgment is anecdotal. I'm basing it off of the content of my social media news feeds. I'm basing it off the fact that I'm currently looking at a Fox News discussion taking place over whether or not Trump has engaged in a significant breach with his base. There's a number of quotes that they were flashing up across the screen from various voters who are Trump supporters who are profoundly and deeply enraged by the fact that the spending bill has been signed by the president. And with cause. With cause. And I'm over here, like I say, the guy who's been at the venue, who's been waiting for the party to start, who's been in the big empty room for quite some time, saying, "Hi guys, how you doing? Good to see you. Welcome back. Welcome. Welcome back to conservatism. Try the water. It's fine." Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. You can catch up on past programs by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app. Our channel will pop right up for you. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brianne taking your calls and producing the program. This is the last night Brianne's going to be with us for the foreseeable future. It's been great having her. She's been in substituting for Brad, who's been off doing military shooting up bang bang stuff for the past month. And it's been fantastic to have you. It's been a real pleasure. I'm acting like we're never going to see you again.
Right. This is a goodbye. Just a placeholder. But yeah. No, I've greatly enjoyed being here with all of you and you yourself, Walter.
So I appreciate that. So, you know, tonight in typical Friday fashion, I have a loose grasp on the reins of the show this evening. By the time I get to the last day of the week, I'm usually so exhausted from my cumulative sleep deprivation over the previous nights that I'm not bringing a lot of energy to the program. This Friday is a little bit different because I'm animated by a couple of things. One, this vote that's taken place on the $1.3 trillion budget, and also the fact that I had an op-ed published in my local newspaper out in the St. Michael, Albertville area in response to the student walkouts that took place earlier this month, and I've gotten some feedback from the community, and I'm interested in talking and sharing that with you guys and talking about it. But other than those two things, you know, which are pretty significant, meaty topics, I'm very open to your guidance tonight on the direction you want the show to go. So by all means, 651-989-5855. You know, some you can call it open lines, you can call it whatever you want. It's your show tonight. So welcome to radio. So I want to start by commiserating with you about what's going on with this budget. I find myself in a position that has become at once familiar and nonetheless disappointing. You know what I mean? If you've ever been in a relationship with somebody, whether it's an intimate relationship or a parental relationship or whatever the case may be, if you've ever had a relationship with somebody who is consistently disappointing you, consistently lets you down, and you keep giving them second chances, third chances, fourth chances, you keep holding out for them to change because you buy into, you know, whatever excuse they're giving you for why they behave the way they do, or the latest effort they're making to supposedly reform or rehabilitate themselves or to turn over a new leaf, whatever the case may be. And then they let you down for like the 5th, 6th, 20th, 42nd time. it becomes to the point where you're simultaneously disappointed. You're simultaneously disappointed and not shocked, right? Like, it doesn't hurt any less to be betrayed the 42nd time, but you've also become kind of numb to it because it is the 42nd time, right? That's how I feel about the Republican Party right now. And it's difficult for me to decide upon which of those two emotions, which of those two reactions to really focus on. The disappointment and, frankly, the disgust at the fact that this is the outcome that we're getting from our elected Republican officials and total Republican control of the federal government, or to try to focus on the aspect of it where, you know, you're trying to look ahead. You're trying to be productive and positive and ask yourself, how do we move forward from this? And I want to try to address both of those things tonight with your guys' help, but it's going to be difficult to sort out the emotions. I'm going to get personal with you guys here on this, because to cut to the chase, we should have a little context before I get into this. In case you haven't heard, from the Associated Press, President Donald Trump grudgingly signed a $1.3 trillion federal spending measure Friday and averted a midnight government shutdown. Thank God, right? Wouldn't want another shutdown. But only after undercutting his own negotiators and setting off a mini panic with a last-minute veto threat. The episode further eroded the already damaged credibility of both the president and the White House staff that had assured the nation he was on board. Trump said he was very disappointed in the package, in part because it did not fully pay for his planned border wall with Mexico and did not extend protections from deportation to some 700,000 Dreamer immigrants due to loose coverage under a program the president himself has moved to eliminate. But Trump praised the bill's provisions to increase military spending and said he had no choice but to fund our military. My highest duty is to keep America safe, he said. The bill signing came a few hours after Trump created his latest round of last-minute drama by tweeting that he was considering a veto. With Congress already on recess and a government shutdown looming, he said that young immigrants now protected in the U.S. under Barack Obama's delayed Action for Childhood Arrivals program have been totally abandoned by the Democrats, not even mentioned in the bill, and the border wall, which is desperately needed for our national defense. It is not fully funded. That was his tweet. That's a typical kind of flighty Trump nuance there in terms of the language that he provides. So, you know, that's the news. Trump signed this $1.3 trillion budget. Now, the problem with this thing is, as has been pointed out by the likes of Justin Amash, who's one of his pages on Facebook, Team Amash, which I'm not quite sure if this is an official Justin Amash page or not, but they had this to say about it. They said the establishment just rammed a massive $1 trillion spending deal through Congress that virtually no one has even read. It includes hundreds of pages of unrelated policy provisions and will pile onto an already unsustainable $21 trillion national debt. We've seen this before. Leadership bargains with Washington power brokers behind closed doors, concocts a deal filled with vote-buying pet projects, then drops it in the lap of rank-and-file members of Congress and tells them to take it or leave it. No discussion or amendments allowed. But this time, when the bill was finally made public, it was over 2,000 pages long, and congressional leaders gave House members less than 24 hours to review it. This top-down, corrupt method of governing is not what the American people voted for. They expect and deserve better. Too many members of Congress have remained silent and been complicit, but Justin Amash will always speak out and fight back. Thanks for standing with Justin as he stands up to the establishment. That was from Team Amash on Facebook. And so that sums up the issue. That sums up the problem with this budget. Now, with that context laid, I was encouraged yesterday because at that time, when I looked at how our Minnesota congressional delegation voted on this, both Tom Emmer, my congressman, and Jason Lewis, former talk radio host, sat in this very chair, broadcast over this very air, had also voted no against this. And I was deeply encouraged by that because I'd been scared. I almost didn't want to look at the vote because I didn't want to discover that they had voted for this. Well, turns out that was only the first vote. There was another vote, a second vote, a final vote on the budget. And on that one, both Jason Lewis and Tom Emmer voted yes. And not only did they vote yes, but their votes collectively passed the thing. An organization called North Star Liberty Alliance put this on Facebook. They said any representative, including Jason Lewis, who voted yes here, voted for a gun grab and all the other provisions of the omnibus boondoggle. In fact, if Representative Lewis and Representative Emmer from Minnesota had voted no, the effort to ram this through would have failed. Now, you know, I haven't verified that that's the case, but for the sake of argument, let's take North Star Liberty Alliance at their word that the reason this passed, it can be truthfully said, is because both Tom Emmer and Jason Lewis voted for it. Now, with that established, when I talk about getting personal, this is what I mean. We've been on the air here with Closing Argument for over a year. And in that time, I have conscientiously avoided talking about our congressional delegation. I've conscientiously avoided talking about Jason Lewis, talking about Tom Emmer, and including them specifically and personally and by name in my criticism of what Republicans are doing in Washington, D.C. And my reasons for that are multifaceted, but I think one of the biggest reasons why I've avoided commenting on them specifically is because these are both men who I respect. In fact, in the case of Jason Lewis, I can truthfully say that Jason Lewis is one of the three most influential people, one of the three most influential minds in my own intellectual and philosophical development. And the list is pretty impressive. Okay, so number one most influential, Jesus Christ. Number two, Ayn Rand. Jason Lewis comes in at number three. Okay, so that's admittedly
a big part of why I'm here too. Yeah, absolutely.
Jason Lewis would be the first one to admit that that's quite a drop off from number two to number three. Like the quality level is a significant drop from Ayn Rand. And I agree, it absolutely is, but nevertheless, he's number three, okay? So it's no small thing for me to say that I'm disappointed in Jason Lewis. It's no small thing for me to say that I feel betrayed by Jason Lewis. I feel as though, you know, all those years, and it was years, you know, I talked earlier this week about my political coming of age and how I discovered Rush Limbaugh when I was in high school and how he played a role in guiding my philosophical development. Well, Jason Lewis was right there alongside him for all those years. It's like if you had a professor or a coach or something who played a significant role in demonstrating certain principles and values to you, and then they do something that's in complete 180 degree violation of everything that they taught you. And Tom Emmer, it's very similar. You know, I consider Tom Emmer to be a friend. Now, we're not besties or anything, right? Like, we don't golf together or go out for coffee or whatever the case may be. I might see him a couple times a year, but nevertheless, I consider him to be a friend. And I know for a fact that he believes the things that I believe. Just like I know for a fact that Jason Lewis believes the things that I believe. And so the question becomes, how are these guys who understand, they're not ignorant, it's not like they don't know what they're doing, how are these guys who believe what you and I believe and who understand the gravity of the decisions that they're making choosing to support this type of legislation and this type of process? I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm very disturbed by the fact that I don't know the answer to that question. And I'm even more disturbed when I try to speculate and contemplate the potential reasons why they voted for this. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Hey, it's Drew from Just...
Well, I tried to make it Sunday, but I got so damn depressed that I set my sights on Monday.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855. I'm in a pretty somber mood for a Friday night. Usually when Friday rolls around, there's a combination of delirium from the cumulative sleep deprivation from the week and also excitement about getting into the weekend, getting to spend time with my family, getting to do things that are not work, because that's all I do from the time I wake up on Monday until the time I go to bed on Friday night. But you know, this is an unusually somber, almost funeral-like atmosphere that I find myself in on this Friday night because of not just the vote that just took place from the GOP-controlled House and the GOP-controlled Senate and was signed by the GOP-nominated President of the United States, Donald Trump, but by the fact that what it indicates, right? Like where it leaves us and just contemplating what it even means. Here's a question I have for you. It's kind of a two-part question. Because look, it's very easy to in the middle of disappointment to make prognostications or to make proclamations, is the word I'm looking for, that go too far, right? Like if I were to sit here and say Republicans are total garbage and you should never vote for a Republican, you know, all Republicans need to be voted out tonight, right? Like if I decided to go that direction, it would be wrong because in point of fact, there are actually worthwhile Republicans out there, right? You've got Justin Amash, who has spoken out against this. You got Rand Paul, who's spoken out against this. We had last night on the program Doug Wardlow, who's running for attorney general here in Minnesota. He has nothing to do with what just took place in Washington, D.C. And his cause and his campaign should be judged on its merits, completely separate of what the Republicans elsewhere are doing, right? So you need to be somewhat nuanced in terms of how you respond to something like this. But the question that I have for you is, what have you gotten for all of your effort, all of your time, any money you've donated, you know, marching in parades, attending conventions, going to caucus? What have you gotten from this full manifestation of Republican power? They're in charge of Congress. They're in charge of the Senate. They're in charge of the White House. Now, there is an answer to this question, right? Like, there's Neil Gorsuch. That's good. We got a tax cut. Yay! We got a tax cut. Okay? Now, these things are important. Don't get me wrong. They have value. Absolutely. But aside from those things, and now we've got this bill, this $1.3 trillion spending bill. And that's all you're going to get, by the way, because the session's over, right? Here, that's all you're going to get for the first 2 years of this administration. Are you satisfied with that? Is this enough? And if it's not enough, have you reached that point? Because everybody has this point. Have you reached that point past which you're not willing to support it any longer? Where you're not actually going to go out and pull the lever for whoever voted for this garbage? Or you're not going to donate to them? Or you're not going to campaign for them? Are you at the point where you're ready to let this affect your behavior, or are you just going to grouch about it? And that's a question I'm asking myself tonight as well. Eric in Minneapolis, welcome to the program.
Hey, Walter, how are you?
Good.
Good. Well, I just want to preface by saying that I totally agree with you. Jason Lewis is so influential growing up, especially in developing my mindset. But I'm looking at this bill, and I don't know how much information is actually out there, but I've skimmed through about, you know, an eighth of it probably. And it's hard to get through. But I guess my question is it possible that there's something in that bill, you know, just that's more than meets the eye? Like, they were very proud of the fact that they avoided all these poison pills. And but I'm just wondering, like, if you think that there's something there that is going to turn out to be much less of a victory for the deep state, for the swamp, than it appears at first glance, and that's why it got through.
So you're suggesting that there's actually something of value that we just don't know about yet that's in this bill?
Just on a subliminal level, like, you know, give them what they want, but, you know, it's Trump. Like, there's something there that's not been disclosed, but he did say in his press conference, too, you know, he was like, they were like, why didn't you veto this?
Mm-hmm.
He said, I wanted to, but he's like, read 20 minutes in, and I haven't gotten, I don't know what that refers to, but he's like, there's a reason that I signed this.
I mean, you know, if there's something specific, he should be calling it out, because that's really poor. I don't understand the point of saying, oh, there's a reason I did it, and not articulating what that reason is. From what I've seen in the stories that I've read about his comments and his response, is he's pointed to the military funding. That's been his big thing, is this funds the military, and that's my first responsibility as commander-in-chief, and so I got to vote for it because we got to have a stronger military. And, you know, if that's all it is, weak tea. Very, very weak tea. I don't buy that for a second. Because this has... Look, sooner or later, the only way this... Because this is a process issue. You know, we had Tom Massey, who, the last time they had one of these ridiculous, you know, the government's going to shut down votes, came out and posted on Facebook. And he was very comprehensive in his analysis of the fact that the reason this happens is because it's structured to happen this way. And it's structured to happen this way on purpose. Leadership doesn't want to have a debate. Leadership doesn't want to be able to consider amendments and to be able to judge things on their merits. They want to be able to cut deals behind closed doors with their cronies and to put it in front of the rank and file and say, you either vote for it or you don't get anything whatsoever. And your constituents won't get anything whatsoever. And your donors will be upset because they're not getting what they want. And your municipalities and your state legislatures will be upset because they're not getting what they want. And they're going to blame you for voting no. That's the position that these guys are placed in. I appreciate your call, Eric. That's the situation that these congressmen find themselves in. You know, when I talk about Jason Lewis and I talk about Tom Emmer, and I ask the question, how can you be Jason Lewis, Mr. Minnesota Right, or Minnesota's Mr. Right, right? Like, how can you be Jason Lewis? You spent decades artfully articulating the principles of liberty far better than I ever could, right? You understand the danger, the hazard of the national debt. You understand how corrupt this process is by which an omnibus bill like this comes about, and you vote for it. Well, the answer to the question is because he answers to city councils, he answers to county boards, he answers to corporations and donors who are in his district who are telling him, we need infrastructure funding. You know, we need to keep the lights on in terms of all these intergovernmental infrastructure deals that keep business going for us. And that's what we care about. We don't care about your process stuff. We don't care about your constitution analysis. We just care about keeping the lights on, keeping the juice flowing, so to speak. And that's the pressure that he's under. And that's the pressure that Tom Emmer's under. Now, I don't offer that as an excuse for either one of them, because it's not. It's not. The only way that stops is at some point, somebody, because we've got a few somebodies who are standing up to it. There needs to be a movement, and it needs to take place within the Congress itself. A movement to push back against the leadership and say, no, we will not do it this way anymore. We will not do it this way anymore. And they need to have the backbone to go back to their donors and back to their communities and stand up in front of their city councils and their county boards and say, I know this hurts. I know you want your funding for your new infrastructure project. I know you want your funding in order to do what's really important to you and what's really important to your constituents. But I had to say no because there's something larger at stake here. There's something more important to the long-term sustainability of this nation that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed now. And whether or not I get reelected is not important. What's important is that we finally do something to stop this madness in Washington, D.C. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Twin Cities News.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. You can catch up on past shows searching for Closing Argument right there in your iHeartRadio app. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. We've been commiserating about the latest betrayal, which I think is, you know, often that word is used in a hyperbolic fashion in political discourse. In this case, it seems pretty accurate. I mean, you know, if what other context would it be more appropriate to use the term betrayal than in reference to voting for a bill that literally does the opposite of everything you've campaigned on? I mean, this isn't even like one issue, right? Like with Senator Scott Jensen here in Minnesota, state legislature, is being called a traitor because he changed his mind on one issue, guns. This omnibus bill coming out of Washington, this $1.3 trillion budget, is a comprehensive betrayal of virtually every issue that Republicans have ever taken a stance on in terms of their rhetoric, their campaign rhetoric. So I'm much more comfortable using that terminology in this situation than I would be in others. Let's go to your calls. Let's start with Douglas in Eagan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, yeah. I was wondering if you could go through that two vote thing again. My wife called me right when you started doing it. I did the right thing and I took her call.
Excellent. Excellent. That was the right thing. I fully support your decision. So the situation with the two votes is that yesterday, I'm not sure exactly when the vote was taken, but there were two votes that were taken. The first was a vote to pass the bill in the House. And on that vote, Jason Lewis and Tom Emmer voted against this omnibus bill, this appropriation bill.
Right.
When it came to the final vote, however, after the Senate had passed their version and it came back to the House for reconciliation, on the final vote, they voted for it, which raises the question, what changed, right?
Like, no, I'm tracking. I got you. I didn't know it had come back. All I heard was they had voted no, and I did not realize it had come back for reconciliation.
Yeah.
All right.
There you go. Appreciate the call.
I feel like you do. I mean, I helped. I didn't do it. I did as much as I could for. I live in Jason Lewis's second district, and I did as much as I could, had time for,
right.
Put signs up, made some phone calls, that kind of stuff, and so, not happy.
Yeah, understood. All right. Let's go to Zach in Lionel Lakes.
Yeah, this is why I'm a Christian Reconstructionist. If you think about it, what does it assume when you think that the best way to affect change is to grab the reins of power. I mean, that's a top-down sort of model. That's a power-centered model. And that's exactly the same religion, essentially, that the left has. See, I believe in a bottom-up sort of thing. Here's the thing. In God's law, I forgot to mention when I was the guest that a lot of God's law, there's no civil penalties attached to those laws. Only some of them have a civil penalty attached to them. And the thing is, God doesn't want us to go start from the top down and fix everything. That's what a lot of people thought the Messiah would be. But Jesus offered a different model. He offered a servanthood leadership model. Don't lord over everybody else like the Gentiles do. But the greatest among you must be a servant. So what if we started from the bottom up? What if we attacked the worldview which made this power-hungry corruption that we see in Washington acceptable to us?
Mm-hmm.
The Bible says also what we plant, we harvest. And if we plant a focus on power and trying to grab the reins of power at the national level first, maybe the state level second, and maybe, if we even get to it, the local level, I mean, that sounds suspiciously like the power-centered model that the world lives like. I want to start from the bottom up, and that starts locally, I think. And that starts with the Holy Spirit changing hearts and minds to love his justice and righteousness.
I appreciate your thoughts as always, Zach, and I do not disagree with him at all. In point of fact, that is the direction that I'm shifting my personal activism. You know, I didn't show up to my local convention this year. Just didn't show up. With guilt-free, by the way. Like, I don't feel a smidgen of guilt about not going. It's the first convention I have not attended in, I don't know, 10 years maybe. And, you know, whatever. What am I going there for? What's the point? What am I trying to attain? What am I going to get for all my trouble, right? I can't answer those questions. And so because whenever you decide to get involved in a political endeavor, there is a opportunity cost, right? Like, what are you giving up in order to do that? And at the minimum, the answer is time. And as I've gotten older, as my family has gotten older, my time has become increasingly valuable. And if I'm not going to get if I'm not going to get results that have integrity with the principles and the values that are expressed from the stages of these conventions, if I'm not going to get people who are actually going to vote accordingly and risk their own electoral hides in order to stand on these principles, then I don't got time for you. I don't care anymore. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to be inactive. It doesn't mean that I'm surrendering, right? Because that's how they get you, right? What they suggest is that, well, you got to vote for us, you got to support us, you got to donate to us, you got to be part of the team, you got to be Team Red, because if you don't, the Democrats are coming, and they're going to do all these horrible things to you. You know, they're gonna encroach upon your rights. They're gonna spend a bunch of money. They're gonna do all the things we're doing, but they're just gonna do it more, right? That's the argument. Well, I'm sorry, but at a certain point, that doesn't carry water anymore. At a certain point, I don't care who's in charge, because as Zach puts it, the culture from which this garbage manifests has become so degraded that you can't fix it at the ballot box anymore. You can't fix it at the legislature anymore. It has to be fixed at its root, in people's hearts and minds, and the values from which these campaigns and politicians and systems spring. That's what we need to focus on. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Sean Hannity.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855. We're just talking tonight. We're just commiserating on this latest vote from your elected Republicans in Washington, D.C. to spend $1.3 trillion and maintain the status quo, fund Planned Parenthood, keep Obamacare going, right? Like, this is what you get for all your trouble, your years, you know, perhaps even decades of supporting and fighting for Republican control. These are the results. Welcome. Enjoy. Let's talk to Abdi in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Walter. Appreciate you having me on. I also appreciate the fact that you're, you know, criticizing our elected officials for going back on what they promised us when we voted for them. But I think even more so, I'm really disappointed with the president. I know I'm kind of, you know, a vehement supporter, and you and I don't see eye to eye on a lot when it concerns President Donald Trump. But here, I think, you know, there is blame on the Republicans in the House and the Senate, except for folks like, you know, Amish and folks like Rand Paul, who spoke out against this. But for the president to say, I'm going to veto this,
right,
and then not, and then say, you know, on the campaign trail, I don't think people should have their tax dollars go to the tune of $500 million to Planned Parenthood.
Right.
And not, he allowed that. And says he's, you know, for the Second Amendment, and there's gun grabs in this, and which I would hope, you know, I don't know if you articulated this earlier on in the show, but if you could talk about that at some length, that would be great, what exactly is in there with the gun grab. But I don't know. There's 7 months to the election in November, and I don't know whether or not these guys are coasting. I mean, do they not know they're up for election, that we're going to remember these kind of decisions and that people will remember this in the midterm? So I'm very confused on that, and I really do think that we have to lay the blame at the president's feet, because he could have vetoed this.
Yes.
And everyone talks about the shutdown, and I think that's the strategy folks like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell went in, because those two are, you know, in the swamp, quote-unquote the swamp, and they don't care. They'll side with Schumer and Pelosi on anything. They have more in line with those folks than they do with their own constituents,
mm-hmm,
which is a shame.
Mm-hmm.
So I just was wanted to hear you speak about that and why a shutdown might not be the worst thing ever, you know, which is the whole reason why this was signed into bill. So thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call as always, Abdi. Look, I mean, it's a continuation of what I was saying going into the break in the last segment, which is that I think what's happening here is it's muscle memory, right? Like these guys, their finger just automatically goes to that yes button. Vote yes, vote yes, vote yes, vote yes. Because of what's at stake in terms of their electoral prospects. Like, to their mind, the question of, do they know they're up for election? Yes. Oh, yes, they do. They absolutely do. And that is what's informing this behavior. Because to their minds, listen, there are two different political realities that people in Congress operate under. There's the political reality that is expressed on this show, that you guys express when you call into this program, where you have an ideological worldview perspective on how things ought to be, and you're concerned about things like principle and the role of government and the condition of liberty and individual rights and the Constitution. There's that context in which candidates have to operate in order, specifically in order to get endorsed, in order to get primary victories, in order to get their name on the ballot in the general election. But something completely different happens. There's a different political reality that's a parallel universe that takes place in the general election. In the general election, and you know, there's actually a third reality, which is once they get elected, the condition they have to operate in order to negotiate being in Congress and trying to get bills passed. And so once they get past you, once they get past the party and the endorsement and the primary, and they get into the general election, now they're suddenly concerned about attracting those independents and making promises to, you know, groups that can endorse them, and looking to their governmental constituencies. You know, I brought up cities, counties, school districts, all powerful forces, which are looking to their congressman, their representative in Congress, to get them goodies, right? And then they go to Washington, D.C., and in order to get those goodies, they have to play ball. That's the context in which this happens. So in order to shift the power dynamic, what needs to happen is we culturally, and it needs to be more than just you and me here, like a radio host and his audience, or even an entire political party, is not going to be enough. This has to be a broad cultural movement, as Zach pointed out, a grassroots, bottom-up movement that needs to take place, where collectively we say, you know what? I'm a little less concerned about whether or not I get a third lane on my freeway, my highway, or whether or not I get a road project approved or an infrastructure project, my wastewater treatment plant funded by the federal government, I'm less concerned about that than I am about the fact that Congress is literally broken, that I am not being represented, that I don't get a voice in the negotiations that produce these omnibus bills, because you don't. You don't. They don't care about your opinion at all. And the system is structured in such a way as to exclude your representation. Your opinion doesn't even make it into consideration at all. And they don't want it to be. And so we have to demand that the system changes, that we're no longer going to tolerate. And this is how it's going to have to work, because this is the way things are structured. The issue has to become, we will not support Congress people who are going to continue to elect leadership that runs the caucuses the way they've run them to date. That's how it's going to have to work. Because, you know, the problem you get to is you demonize somebody like, trying to remember his name, John Boehner. You demonize John Boehner. You say, John Boehner's so horrible. And then you get him out of there, and here comes Paul Ryan. And new boss, same as the old boss, right? Because you focused on the personality. You focused on the guy instead of the system that produced the guy. So we need to shift our focus to the system. We need to shift our focus to, why is it that somebody, because, you know, Paul Ryan is very similar to Jason Lewis and Tom Emmer in the sense that he believes this stuff. He believes what you and I believe. You may not think so based upon his actions, and you could be forgiven for not thinking so, but he does. He's just surrendered to his circumstances. He's surrendered to the system, which, you know, he helped craft and helps perpetuate. Because in his mind, it's a higher consideration to maintain majorities and to get reelected. And he believes that the only way that's going to happen is by playing ball the way it's always been played. Well, we have to change that. And we're the only ones who can. And this is a broad collective we. It's not just Republicans. It's not just conservatives. All of us, the culture, need to put our foot down and say, no, we're not going to play this game anymore. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We're going to get into talking about guns when we come back, and the latest stories on that, quite amusing and infuriating. We'll continue to take your calls on this and anything else you want to talk about tonight, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Thanks for listening to
Oh boy. It's a tough night. Fridays are usually tough for me, but you know, in the context of what we're talking about tonight, with just everything coming to a head with Republicans, and you know, realizing that politics, and this is my personal realization, maybe you're somewhere else, and I'm interested from hearing from you, 651-989-5855. But the point that I'm at is, I don't think the political process on the whole, with some exceptions, right? Like there, you know, there may be some local races, there may be some candidates for state legislature or candidates for a statewide office or whatever the case may be that are worth supporting, worth voting for, worth getting out there and marching and parade for, whatever the case may be. But on the whole, the idea that we're going to save the world, we're going to restore the republic, you know, we're going to save the Constitution through federal politics, I think we've pretty much exhausted the viability, the veracity of that idea. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855, again, is the number to join us. Appreciate you doing so. Brianne taking those calls and producing the show. Let's talk to Steve He's out and about.
Good evening.
Welcome to the program. Yeah.
So my question is, what drives a person to ever want it to become, to get involved with politics to begin with? You know, is it power? Do they think they can make a change for the better, for the person, for themselves only, or for the world, for whoever? Or is it strictly financial? Because what I've heard is, like, a lot of these politicians get things like life insurance for the rest of their lives once they've, you know, been elected, no matter for how long they've served, things like that. I don't know anything about that kind of stuff, or that's just hearsay, or what the deal is. But so, what drives a person other than what I suggested, pretty much?
Well, I think, you know, if you're going to take people at their word, which I think to a certain extent we should, right, in the absence of evidence to the contrary, then I think what drives people to politics is a sincere desire to affect change, positive change for the world in which they live. I mean, look, you know, these people who we send to not just Congress, but to St. Paul or to your city hall or, you know, whatever the case may be, they live in this country too, right? You know, they're raising kids, they're trying to make a living, and they have the same concerns that you and I have about the future of this country. The problem is that we have a system that is structured in such a way that it takes good people and it chews them up and it digests them and it spits them back out as something completely different, as people who have been beaten down and have succumbed and surrendered to what they would call the political reality, right? The notion that, well, things are done a certain way, and it's better that I'm here than that the other side is here. And if you want to prevent the other side from, you know, running roughshod and giving you the next Obamacare or giving you the next, you know, Supreme Court justice who is going to vote the wrong way on a variety of social issues, then you're going to have to just reelect me regardless of what it is that I do here. And that's the process.
That sounds good. You know, I see people with a lot of money running all the time. And why is it only the people with a lot of money? Well, it's probably because they're the only ones that can afford
that's
it.
Right. That's
all
right.
The money that's raised in these campaigns, I mean, why couldn't, you know, the blue-collar guy like me do it? But, you know, obviously, you know, there's a lot of money involved. And I just think the people that run the country are always got deep pockets. And I think they're everything you said I agree with, but I think their main concern is only about themselves and their money. It always comes down to money, you know. And
well, I mean, it's definitely, and this is part of how, and I appreciate your call, Steve, this is part of how they get chewed up and spit out, and part of how they change, is that what the vast majority of a congressperson's time is spent fundraising. That's like 90% of what they do. If they're not fundraising for their own campaign, they're fundraising for the caucus, they're fundraising for the Republican Party, they're fundraising, you know, to try to shift the electoral landscape nationally. You know, I evoked Tom Emmer earlier in the program. He has a key role in the congressional leadership when it comes to trying to elect Republicans nationwide. And so that's a consideration that he has to factor into his decision-making when he goes to cast a vote. You know, retaining the position that he has, and also doing whatever he feels in his judgment is most likely going to result in expanding majorities. And he has to answer to people who are not you and not me. He has to answer to people who expect him to produce results, right? And so in that context, in spite of what he believes, and I know he believes the right things, I know he has the right values, in that context, he's going to be funneled. And again, I'm not trying to make an excuse for him. I'm not. I don't think it's excusable, but it is what's happening. He's being funneled in a particular direction, and that is to go along to get along, quite literally. All right, let's shift the topic here. And we can continue to take calls on that. And in fact, on a Friday evening, I keep a pretty loose grip on the reins of the program. So if there's anything out there that you want to talk about, there's news that Donald Trump has just banned transgenders from the military. I haven't read anything about that as of yet. Of course, I recall when he expressed his intention to do so last year, and we talked about it on the program rather extensively, and perhaps we'll get into that here later in the program. But if you want to talk about that, feel free to 651-989-5855. I want to go through some of this gun stuff From the Daily Wire, on Wednesday, the superintendent of the Democrat-heavy Broward County Public Schools announced a new policy aimed at reducing school violence, and the students are not happy. Superintendent Robert W. Runcie, a proponent of radical left-wing gun control measures, announced that students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School will only be allowed to bring clear backpacks to school after spring break and will be required to wear a new ID badge at all times. You know, I saw this characterized on social media as, you know, students protest for more government and they get more government. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening here. Continuing at the Daily Wire, needless to say, the students are not happy with the decision that the Democratic officials came up with to address the issue of school violence. And then they provide a number of tweets to that effect of different students who are objecting to it. There was a CNN quote. Some students have said they're not happy with the changes. Tyra Hemans, 19, a senior, told CNN she supports parts of the new policy, such as the ID requirement, but she believes other security measures, such as forcing students to carry clear backpacks, don't adequately address the real problem with school safety, which she says is lax gun laws. And then here's her quote, her money quote. "I'm not happy with it. Why are you punishing me for one person's actions?" Oh, the deep, deep, deep irony. Yeah. Well, that's exactly what you're advocating for there, sweetheart. Punishing innocents, punishing law-abiding citizens for the actions of one person, for the actions of a few who are not indicative of the whole. From NPR, the battle over firearms has officially entered the digital realm. YouTube announced that it will place more restrictions on firearms videos hosted on its website, and the move has angered some gun enthusiasts who are now publishing their content on a large porn site. Starting next month, YouTube will ban videos that offer instructions on how to make firearms and accessories such as silencers and bump stocks. It will prohibit content in which firearms and accessories are sold, both directly and through other websites. Videos on how to install firearm modifications will also be barred. YouTube says the changes expand on existing policies. "We routinely make updates and adjustments to our enforcement guidelines across all our policies," a spokesperson for YouTube said in a statement. "While we've long prohibited the sale of firearms, we recently notified creators of updates we will be making around content promoting the sale or manufacture of firearms and their accessories, specifically items like ammunition, Gatling triggers, and drop-in auto sears. If in the fall, YouTube banned videos that featured advice on how to make guns fire more quickly, such as by using bump stock devices. The move came after 58 people were killed in Las Vegas on the mass shooting on October 1st. And so, you know, this news came out that YouTube was going to restrict all these gun videos. And I said at the time on social media that this, along with certain other things that have come to light as of late, particularly how Facebook has decided that it's going to, you know, have, it's going to lean in to a particular worldview and that it's going to take a position on politics and it has changed its algorithms to try to fight back against quote fake news unquote and is being discriminatory against conservative content, which look, they have the right to do that, right? Like YouTube has the right to make this policy. Facebook has the right to make their policies. They're private entities, they're private companies. This is not a violation of your free speech rights. All right, let's be clear about that. But from a market perspective, they're setting up a situation where they're creating a huge vulnerability for themselves. Because it's not going to take much for an enterprising competitor to decide that there's an opportunity here to create a platform where the selling point, the value that's added, that is superior to Facebook or superior to YouTube, is that they have all the same features, but they're going to leave you alone. They have all the same features, but they're going to respect your privacy and they're going to respect the freedom of association, and they're not going to take a position on politics, take a position on content. That, you know, and look, the proper way to restrict content is to let the user restrict it, right? I mean, you know, certainly if you're talking about something where like terrorist videos, like terrorist recruitment videos, or something where people are actively advocating for engaging in violence against other human beings, I think we'll all forgive you for taking that content down. But the idea that, oh, a guy's showing you how to add something onto your gun, right? Or how to use this particular firearm or whatever the case may be. So there's something inherently bad or dirty about that needs to be relegated to a porn site now, apparently. That's something that strains credibility. All right. When we come back, I posted a guest column, an op-ed to my local newspaper, the Crow River News, out in the North Wright County area. And I want to share it with you when we come back, and also share some of the feedback that I've gotten from folks in the community. It's very fascinating to me. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
The Joe Pag.
From the Star Tribune, they've staged massive walkouts from school. They've publicly called out the National Rifle Association and local lawmakers. Now they're taking their fight for stricter gun laws to their largest stage yet, the nation's capital. Hundreds of Minnesota students are traveling to Washington, D.C. this week to join a large wave of young activists planning to participate on Saturday in the mother of all student marches to protest gun violence. The March for Our Lives demonstration, organized by the Florida students who survived one of the deadliest school shootings in U.S. history, is expected to draw 500,000 people, organizers say. For the young Minnesotans going to D.C., the march offers a rare opportunity to make their voices heard on an issue they care deeply about. And then goes on to quote the various folks involved, which, you know, are adults who are the heads, the executive directors and such of nonprofit organizations engaged in political activism. So, yeah, it's about the kids. Just remember, it's about the kids and what the kids think, and it's all coming from the kids. Uh-huh. Now, listen, I actually don't have a problem with this. Like, I don't agree with them. I don't agree with their position on the issue. But I don't have a problem and actually fully endorse the notion of students taking a trip to Washington, D.C., during spring break, in some cases, no doubt, on a weekend to engage in a political demonstration on the National Mall. That's fantastic. Good for them. I don't have to agree with their point in order to applaud and support that type of engagement, because that's how the discourse actually happens, right? That's substantially different from the walkouts themselves. You know, the walking out from school is something that crosses a very particular line. It's a rejection of the system. It's revolutionary rather than participatory. Because what it suggests is the only possible way in which I can make my case, the only possible way in which I can engage in the discourse, is by doing something dramatic and theatrical to get your attention, right? Okay, well, you got my attention. Now what, right? Like, what has your argument changed? Have the facts changed? Have the circumstances changed? Because unless you're bringing something of substance that's new that I didn't know about before, merely getting my attention just annoys me. Okay? Like, if you don't have something to say that's new and different, if you don't have a new argument, a new set of facts, new context to examine, then all you're doing is making noise. And what I have the audacity to suggest in an op-ed that got published to the Crow River News, my local newspaper up in the Wright County area, is that as adults, as educators, as parents, as people who have a mentorship role in bringing up children, with the goal, hopefully, I mean, I assume that the goal of raising your kids and educating your kids is to bring them up into maturity, into adulthood, capable of conceiving of and pursuing rational values and being able to engage in civil society in a productive, effective, life-affirming way. I'd like to assume that we're all on board with that goal. And if, in fact, that is the goal, you need to explain to me how condoning or tolerating school walkouts for the purpose of political protest gets us in towards that objective, points us in that direction, because I'm not seeing it. And it's interesting, the arguments that I've heard in response to this idea, it falls into a few categories. One is, the first thing that people talk about is free speech. You know, well, these students are exercising their free speech rights. That should be applauded. Well, okay, that premise is completely invalid, because this is not about speech. You know, this goes back to what we were talking about yesterday with the protests in the highways, the protests at the Mall of America, blocking infrastructure, blocking streets, trespassing on private property. There is a separation, a meaningful, objective, distinct, obvious separation between the content of somebody's speech, the ability to speak, and conduct tangential to that. I'm not saying the kids shouldn't talk, right? The kids should shut up and keep their opinions to themselves. That's not the point I'm making at any point. What I'm saying is they shouldn't be leaving school to do so. And their ability to make their point is not dependent upon leaving school. The purpose of leaving school is something completely different than being able to engage in their free speech right. And that's indicated by another one of the pushback talking points that I've received in response to this article, which is that, well, this is the way to get attention to the issue. And these students should be supported because they're doing something dramatic in order to bring attention to something that people don't want to talk about. Okay, well, that goes back to what I said at the outset, which is, you got my attention, now what? Because getting people's attention doesn't change minds. Persuasive arguments do. Evidence does. Reasons do. So if you didn't have an argument before you walked out of school that was persuasive, if you couldn't demonstrate to me that the safety and security of my children was at stake prior to walking out of the school, what is it about the act of walking out that's suddenly going to, you know, cast the light from heaven and have the scales fall away from my eyes and get me to finally understand how important your cause is? I'm very interested in talking to the person whose mind has been changed because they saw kids walk out of a school. You know, who had one stance on guns, was a fervent supporter of gun rights and the Second Amendment, and then they saw some kids walk out of a school and thought, wow, these guys are serious. I guess I'm going to have to completely reconsider everything that I previously thought about guns. If you're that person, 651-989-5855, I want to talk to you. Michael in St. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Walter. Good evening to you. Yep. I was thinking, I really just believe their outrage is misdirected. And I've mentioned this before. We have this whole component in society, what I would call the grievance culture. Somebody's in an uproar and upset about something, and they're going to make a lot of loud noises about it. But from a practical standpoint, what has really changed? If we go back to Parkland, what things have been put in place to protect the students? What's going to be any different if these gun laws are enacted, if another mentally evil, unbalanced person gets a weapon and wants to come into the school or a business and create mayhem? I don't think that they're going to be protected, and their outrage really should be directed at the people in government that all along the way here, I guess even the FBI and other agencies, let these kids down, and there's been something going on with that police department as well.
Yeah, I mean, that speaks to the point that I'm trying to make here, which is that if the premise upon which folks are justifying what the students did is they're saying it's so important. Basically, they're loading their conclusion into the premise of their argument, which is that we have to do something about guns. We have to restrict gun ownership and access to weapons in order to protect the children. And because that's so important, that justifies them walking out of school. And it's only for 17 minutes, don't you know? You know, why are you so upset about 17 minutes, right? So they're minimizing the deed itself, which I think is kind of oddly counterproductive, because if your whole point is we need to do something dramatic to get attention, and then you're trying to minimize the impact of what it is that you did, but whatever. If the whole point is that you need to do something dramatic in order to draw attention to something that's really important, then you need to be able to demonstrate that importance regardless of how you draw attention to it. So if you didn't have me sold on the notion that my kids, because I got kids in school, right? Like I don't want my kids to get shot. Can we assume that? Can we proceed on that assumption? I appreciate your call, Mike. Can you grant me that much respect to assume that I don't want my children to get shot? Okay. So I'm concerned about security. I'm concerned about safety. If you haven't been able to convince me that restricting gun ownership is the way to ensure my kids are going to be safe and secure, what makes you think walking out of school is going to be the thing that tips the scale for me? Is going to be the thing that makes me go, that's right. Absolutely. Of course. Now I see clearly. Obviously, for the sake of my children, I need to change my mind on guns. There's no logic to this. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. 24 hours.
It's another tequila sunrise.
Taking a strong stance against guns hasn't helped out Dick's Sporting Goods. From the Daily Wire, despite acknowledging on CNN last week that his decision to embrace the gun control movement will result in people who don't shop us anymore for anything, Dick's Sporting Goods CEO Edward Stack entrenched his company even further in the divisive debate this week by penning an op-ed for the Washington Post in which he called on Congress to do something about guns. As a gun owner, I support the Second Amendment. This is the guy in question, Edward Stack, writing. I support the Second Amendment and understand why, for many, the right to bear arms is as American as baseball and apple pie, but I also agree with what Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia wrote in his majority opinion in 2008's landmark Heller case. Like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. It is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for any purpose. It is clear we have a problem with the gun laws in this country. They are not squarely focused on keeping all of us safe, especially our children, he continued. There continue to be mass shootings at our schools, churches, and entertainment venues. Following each of these senseless, tragic events, there's a great deal of idle, fruitless talk in the halls of Congress. And then the conversation quickly comes to an end. It's interesting, isn't it? Like another one of the loaded premises that is constantly being injected into this debate is that there's a lot of idle, fruitless talk. Well, perhaps inaction, the dreaded inaction, is in fact the right thing to do. Like, that's a possibility, right? Like, if you have enough humility to embrace the possibility that you might be wrong, then taking action on your wrong idea would be the wrong choice, would it not? So this notion that, this idle, fruitless talk in the halls of Congress, I think the fruit has been just fine for the most part. The fruit has been thus far could be better, but to a somewhat enjoyable degree, the preservation of our Second Amendment rights. And I'm okay with that. Now, taking this position as the CEO of a sporting goods company, it's very odd. It's very, very strange. Has not boded well for Dick's Sporting Goods. They are seeing, as described at the Daily Wire, deeper than expected slowdown in sales basically across the board. Dick's Sporting Goods, Inc. has vowed to limit sales of guns. Its problem, however, is poor sales of everything else, Fortune reports. Only weeks after winning accolades from gun control advocates for ending sale of assault rifles at its Field & Stream stores, Dick's posted a deeper-than-expected sales decline. Its stock sank the most in 4 months Tuesday in the wake of the quarterly report, which reflected struggles with excess inventory and deep discounting. And, of course, they make the case that, oh, no, it's not really about our stance on guns. This is just other retail issues that we're dealing with. There's no connection to this whatsoever. Yeah. Let's talk to you, Corey, in Bloomington. How are you doing tonight, Corey?
Pretty good. How are you doing, Walter?
I'm doing all right. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was wondering...
Are you there? Did you just fall off your chair? What's going on, Corey?
Sorry, I dropped the phone. Is this Open Mind Friday?
Yes.
More or less.
More so than it has ever been. You literally opened the line there just now.
Okay, yeah, I dropped the phone.
What's on your mind?
Okay. Is this Open Mind Friday?
Yep. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I broke my AT&T phone, so I'm calling you from my home phone.
I can believe that story. I appreciate it, Corey. It's obvious that he's fully capable of breaking a phone. He almost broke another one. So there we go.
God bless him.
Let's talk to Al in Edina. Follow that, Al.
Hey. That's going to be a tough show to follow. I agree with some of the things you mentioned about the kids, their activism towards the shootings and all that. Mm-hmm. One thing I kind of disagree with you with is the fact that they're making noise just to make noise. I think part of the problem that one of the things that they're addressing is the fact that they want something to be done. Now, I disagree with what they're specifically asking about. I think they should be addressing the issues that were all the things that were already in place that would have prevented this had they worked. Mm-hmm. The problem is people, things fell through the cracks. The guy didn't come into the policeman didn't come into the shooter's room. The guy got there was the mental health issue with this guy who was supposedly on the police radar for years and nothing happened. All these things that should have prevented him from doing this didn't work. So I think that they should be addressing that. But I think the biggest thing that they're trying to do is it's kind of like how advertising works. How many times a day how many times in a football game do you see a Budweiser advertisement?
Right.
The same one. The reason they do it is because it's repetitive. And
sure.
Unless it's repetitive, people forget.
Right.
So
but
that's why it's being effective, just making noise. One of the points that I think is that they may not have an answer, and that's why they're looking to Congress to come up with some things. They may not have the idea what to do, but don't forget about it. Basically, they're saying, don't forget about it. Work on it.
What I'm suggesting is that, because you're right, when you have something, the concept of advertising is, the concept of sales, period, as you well know, is that you have something of value and you're trying to get the word out about it. And what I'm suggesting is what they're selling is a dud. And so it doesn't matter how much attention you bring to it. If you haven't added value to it, if you haven't changed your argument, if you haven't convinced me that gun control is the way to make my children safer, which, you would think that would be a pretty easy sell, right? Like I love my kids, right? I want my kids to survive. I don't want my kids to get shot up in their school. So if in fact you have a case which can rationally demonstrate that certain laws need to be passed in order to reasonably prevent that from happening, that should be a very easy sell. If you can't sell me on that before you walk out of the school, I'm not sure how walking out of the school makes your case better. How attention is the issue. And, to keep your advertising metaphor going, You know, I don't care how big of an ad buy you have, how many times you're in front of eyes and ears. If what you're selling is olive flavored breakfast pastries or whatever the case may be, if you're selling something that nobody wants and that people don't agree with, then it doesn't matter how much you get it in front of them. And we see this with politics all the time.
I agree with that. I think I don't know. I guess I haven't really watched what these guys are quote unquote selling, but I think that the idea is to have people not forget that it's an important issue.
Sure.
And then, you know, they may not have the answer. Maybe they think they have the answer. Like I said, I haven't been watching them very closely. I think a lot of people have said that their big thing is gun control, mm-hmm. and where I think that, and maybe that isn't the right answer, but the fact that they're saying we need to try to do something about this, and maybe the thing to do about it is to make sure that people who are in this process of allowing people to get guns, and if it falls within the realm of they're not supposed to get guns because the laws currently in place say, you know, if you have a mental health issue, you shouldn't have a gun. Or if you're on the FBI's radar, you shouldn't be able to get a gun. That seems to have fallen through the cracks in a number of times in the last in the last few years on some of these shootings. Whether it's a school shooting or this guy that shot up the lunch get together up in San Francisco or wherever that was,
mm-hmm.
He was on FBI's radar, but he shouldn't have been able to get a gun, but he still was able to.
Yeah.
How does this fall through the cracks so many times? Maybe that's what should be addressed.
I agree.
People should say that's what we need to address. The kids are saying, do something, don't do nothing.
Well, I wish that's what they were saying, but they're taking a very, very clear, very strong anti-gun position that's being led by some organized folks who have been involved in the fight against the Second Amendment for a long time. I appreciate your call, Al. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. iHeartRadio. You may have not even noticed we were gone on that one. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Last segment of the week to join us. Appreciate you doing so. Let's go right to Eric in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Evening.
As I'm listening, the gun control and them wanting to take our guns away at 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the military, we had guns when we were 18 years old. We used to go to school with our guns, and afterwards. Things have changed so drastically, but I think my biggest fear is when I walk out of the street at 3 o'clock, out of my house at 3 o'clock in the morning in uptown Minneapolis, and I see literally 15 people canvassing a road and walking down the road, going from car to car. And then I see guys, spotters up on the left-hand side and down on the right-hand side. And I know that I'm done. This is walking out of my house in 35th Avenue, right next to Hennepin, 35th Avenue over there. And this is what's going on. And if we were to take our guns away, how do we protect, if you can answer, anyone can answer me, how we can protect me from that kind of stuff that happens in my neighborhood? My garage gets broken into 2 or 3 times a year. I don't even lock it anymore because they used to break my windows. Now I just leave my doors open. It's easier. How, with everything that's already on the street, you can't depend upon the law-abiding citizen. But you also can't ask the law-abiding citizen to walk calmly to the slaughter. Because if all the guns are gone, what do we do then?
Yeah, I've got nothing of substance to add to what you're sharing. I mean, that you put a nice bow on it. That's exactly right. You need to be... Look, you have a right to life. You have a right to property. And if the government isn't going to do their job or is incapable, and their job is limited, or, I mean, their ability to protect you is limited by just the fact that they're not physically next to you. They don't sleep in you or sleep next to you in your bed, right? Like they're not there instantly to respond. So you need to have some capacity to defend yourself. And who is the government? You know, who are these kids from Parkland to tell you what means you can utilize to that end? I appreciate your call, Eric. All right, let's go to Lou in Champlin. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Walter.
How's it going?
Good. You know, as far as the politicians making their decision, I think it all comes down to the economics and politics of it, and nobody wants to be the guy who throws the final straw on the camel's back. So just keep kicking the can down the road and see what happens.
You're talking about, are we switching back to the budget conversation here?
Yeah. Yeah, the first hour conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you know, people don't want to talk about the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of smooth it all over. But, I mean, do you think that maybe we're facing a bear market?
I don't know, man. If I had the expertise to be able to prognosticate about the direction of the market, then I'd be in a much better financial situation than I'm currently in. But I'll tell you this, to the extent that, because we have seen a prospering market in recent months,
yeah.
And I would attribute that in to some degree, at least, to the tax cuts and to the cutbacks in regulation and to the general sense of confidence that businesses and entrepreneurs have that there's somebody who has their back in the White House, that I think that definitely factors into it. I wouldn't throw all the credit at the feet of Donald Trump, but we've also seen drops. We've seen the stock market pull back, and that seems to have corresponded with announcements like we're going to put on tariffs on steel, we're going to put tariffs on aluminum. Yeah. And so I think what the government, the extent to which the government interferes in the market has a huge effect upon the ups and the downs.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's certain realities though that aren't really being addressed. I just know from talking to people, I know a friend of mine who his son, just started as a civil engineer in another city, started at $50,000 a year. I thought it might be higher than that, but I guess that's what it was. There is, and a one-bedroom apartment is $1,500 a month,
mm-hmm.
So that's $18,000 a year. And if you're making $50,000, I don't know what he's actually taking home, and if you figure out food and insurance and transportation and utilities and so on and so forth. I mean, this kid has got his, I'm sure he's got his college paid for, and he's probably got a nice older used car.
Mm-hmm.
So he's all right there. But if he didn't have that, boy, he'd really be, you know, maybe he'd be bartending at nights too on top of that. So and you know, there's some other stories that I see too, or I've heard where, you know,
well, I mean, if we're talking about, if we're going anecdotal, which it sounds like we are, there does seem to be two different realities manifesting in the economy right now. Because on the one hand, you know, the situation you describe is much more indicative of what my situation is with my family and what my peer group, you know, folks who are just trying to make ends meet and, you know, raise their kids and what have you. But then I also see in my day job, you know, because I spend a lot of time traveling around the metro area, just sure. Booming development. I mean, things are being built all over the place, including ridiculously expensive houses. Now, who's buying these houses? You know, obviously somebody's making money. I don't know who they are and I don't know what they do, but somebody out there is making a ton of bank, and it's a lot of people because these developments are popping up all over the place and they're continuing to expand. And so I don't know if that's all just all consumer debt, like they're not actually making the money. I suppose that's a possibility.
Well, I think a lot of it is that. I think that, you know, I just know, I mean, I'm talking about affordability. Like with the younger people coming up, I mean, this guy is a civil engineer, and then I hear of like tradespeople. I've heard three stories where, oh, the millennials are lazy. They quit their $29 an hour job. And the third time I heard that, I said, well, hold on here a minute. You know, I've heard this before, and maybe there's a different reality here that on $29 an hour that maybe they really can't afford to get into a $250,000 house, or maybe they can, but they see that it's, if you start figuring out the numbers and everything on that, maybe some of these people, they're quitting. I mean, this is something that I'm thinking of, is maybe they're staying at home and renting out the downstairs, you know, with mom and dad, or maybe dad's gone and mom needs a renter or whatever, and they're taking their bartending job and they got their weekend slot and they don't make as much money, but they're actually better off because...
Right. Yeah, I'm following the picture you're painting. Have you come to any sort of conclusions, or?
Well, I think we've got a huge, I think we've got bubbles, and I think we need a realignment of things. And
I'll tell you this much. And again, you know, I'm just speaking anecdotally. I definitely feel an unspoken of economic pressure out there in the world that is counter to a lot of the fundamental indicators that we're seeing, like all that development, all that booming development, the stock market going up, you know, corporations being confident about the future and what have you.
You know, I watch the real estate market. I've been around it, and I know they're building the big two stories down by me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that 10 years ago, that now there's starting to be a turnover, and I'm driving through these neighborhoods that where people just moved in 3-4 years ago, and, you know, some of these houses are popping up for sale. You know, and I think these people are saying, boy, we're over our heads, honey. We can't downsize something.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's the pressure that I'm talking about. I sense a lot of people who are right on that edge of needing to make that kind of a choice of we got to do something smaller. And I think eventually the direction that it ends up going is a consolidation of the generations, where you're actually going to potentially see, like you've already brought up, kids moving in with mom. Well, the other side of that is going to be retirees moving in with their kids. And I think that's something that's going to be coming as this this silver wave, as they talk about it, ends up cresting. I appreciate your call, Lou. Fascinating, meandering topic there. Very depressing. There hasn't been a lot of positivity tonight. I'm sorry I haven't been able to send you into your weekend with, you know, sunshine and fairy dust. I wish I could. I wish I was that guy. I try to be as optimistic as here. Let me attempt to conjure 30 seconds of optimism. All right. We still have control over our individual lives. We still have power to decide what our influence is going to be within the sphere of influence that we've been gifted with by God. And so you go forth this weekend, next week, from this day forward, and you promote good, wholesome, life-affirming values. Spread that productivity, that rationality, that life-affirming goodness to other people, and hopefully it catches on and we can see some real fundamental bottom-up change in the world. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Broadcasting on AM